Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Everybody, my name is Neil White, and this is the Big Interview Q&A show, a special one today with me, Graham Hunter, host of The Big Interview, and Pete Jensen of La Liga Television, who is our guest for these monthly shows. Today, we're looking at the Champions League final that takes place tomorrow in Portugal between Chelsea and Manchester City. To start, though, we want to look at the Champions League final from 10 years ago, Wembley Stadium, Manchester United versus Barcelona, and Pep Guardiola's crowning achievement with a team some people have as the best of all time. Guardiola, of course, is at the helm of the City side, going for a treble of League Cup, Premier League and Champions League. But how does this version of Pep compare to the man who took Barcelona to those incredible heights in 2011? And how have his big ideas changed? Graham Hunter is too modest to tell you that he was hanging out with Pep this week for one of those interviews he does for other people. Graham, you spoke to Pep in 2011. How would you compare those two guys, and what was Pep like when you caught up with him this week?
You know, it's, the difference I'm about to point out may be to do with me being a complete pain in the arse. But I did interview Pep in 2011, just before Wembley, having interviewed him in 2009, just before Rome. And in that Wembley moment, UEFA said to him, okay, you're a finalist now. Let's have your mandatory interview. And he was like, no. And they're like, what? He said, I'll do something for the program. I'll sit down, but no cameras, no photography, and only one person's allowed in. So the UEFA chief who was coming with me to coordinate it wasn't allowed in. And we went into his offices at the training ground, past the outer office was where Tito Villanova, the late Tito Villanova, sat almost like a sort of, not quite like a guard dog, but it did feel like you had to get past Tito first to go into Pep's inner sanctum. And when we sat there in 2011, I fed him some of the same lines as 2009, just to see if he wanted to develop on them. And instead, he wanted to go in completely the other direction. In 2009, it was a big deal to him that during the economic crisis, with people he knew having lost their jobs and worrying for their, what's an hipoteca, mortgages, he felt that the way that Barcelona had you know, risen like a phoenix and played attractive, daring football in 2009, and that treble had been of value to society, value to the people who weren't necessarily in his environment but were fans of Barcelona and had something to cling on to. So I threw some of that back to him. But so look, it's Alex Ferguson again. He's always been daring, front foot, and your team, you always want your team to be attractive, and he's... No. He said, we only play this way to win. There is no correlation between the way we play in 2011 ahead of Wembley, having knocked out Real Madrid in one of the most dramatic European semi-finals of all time. It's only about winning. Entertainment is a byproduct. And so we had what was a perfectly interesting and amenable 25 minutes. The piece was written for the programme. And although I've been in his presence and interviewed him a little bit since, the most important set to came the other day with Pep on Zoom and me on Zoom. And the difference, not just the difference in that interview, but, you know, Neil, you helped publish a book that Pep was a real close collaborator in. Pete knows Pep's close associates, family, very, very well. We've each of us had exposure to the Pep Guardiola that you see on camera, that exists off camera, and in his moments of not doubt, but self-reflection. And first of all, this time I saw a guy that was hugely relaxed. It was off the back of the Brighton game, so he shouldn't have been. He was in a good mood. He was happy. He wanted to talk. Maybe you were asking about the differences in football terms, but people would be equally good, better about describing that, and I'm sure we'll get into it. But he isn't the same man. He's as competitive. He is as spiky. You want to be very careful about when you tread on his toes and how you say things, because he's sharp and he's quick and he's not at all afraid of jutting his chin out. But the Pep that I talked to was articulate and interesting and wanted to be on these subjects, and that made it fun, and it made it a little bit different from the 2011 version.
Did he say when he's coming on the big interview? Has he given us a date?
He said he was pissed off. Actually, I'm glad you raised this. He says you don't pick up when he calls.
He's a liar. He's playful.
I said,
playful.
Yeah, that's Neil. That's Neil.
Okay, we have a first question from an associate today. Ian Boddy, thank you very much for sending this one in. Why did Pep really leave Football Club Barcelona? At the time, he said he'd run out of gas and cited Cruyff's view that a coach should only stay 3 seasons. Has that changed as he's now extending his stay at City? Or did his journey via Germany lead him to want to build something similar to Bayern, which he couldn't have done at Barcelona? Pete, has Pep's longevity at City surprised you, given what we saw towards the end of his tenure at Camp Nou?
It hasn't. It has in the sense that he did seem as if he was set to always, just spend three years at a club. But it hasn't, because I think he, in some ways, has run out of alternatives. And that's not, that sounds like a harsh thing to say about City and about the Premier League. But I think, where would he go now? He does not want to come back to Barcelona. He could not possibly go anywhere else in Spain. Italy maybe would be an option. I don't really see him in League One. International management will probably be the next step. But I think that's played a part in his decision to stay at City, the fact that where else am I going to be better off? So in that sense, it hasn't surprised me.
And then just sort of more broadly, this kind of change of philosophy. And Ian asks specifically whether it was just burnout that brought his time at Barcelona to an end. This far removed from those events, have we learned anything else about his final days at Barcelona?
No, well, hold on. If we go to the grain of Ian's question, we already knew when Sandro Rosé won the elections in 2010 that Pep had him pegged as a bad un, and that's being generous to Sandrusco. Their relationship already wasn't great. Begiristain had seen the election of that president as a reason to leave. In the interview, I didn't ask him about leaving in 2011, but when I asked him about the atmosphere of the final in 2011 and whether there were things to take forward from the preparation, from the mental state, from the Wembley era to now, in the midst of his answer, he said, after the Wembley victory, I felt something was over and that it was time to move on. In the end, I stayed for a year. Retrospectively, he looks on that year as a mistake. He realised it was a mistake very early in the pre-season for his last season. In Take the Ball, both Dani Alves and Victor Valdes talk about the intense change they saw in him, how irritable he was, how he would ball out previously trusted lieutenants on the pitch, lieutenants in training over very little. And it wasn't so much about what the players were actually doing, it was about him cursing himself and going, this has been a mistake, I've made a mistake. And so Ian, that last, Cruyff said before the Wembley final, this is the time to leave. It's not that Pep ignored him, it was the sort of supernova effect of the way they won and the plaudits afterwards and the feeling that maybe there was one more Champions League to compensate for the one that they shouldn't have lost the previous year in 2010. And therefore, from that mistake, bred real, would you say self-recrimination, I think, from Pep, and a deep dislike of Rosset, which it's not hard to share. And therefore, the leaving was delayed by a year. It slightly besmirched the... And Estiartian take the ball, says that even on that last day of Pep's reign at Barcelona, when they win... In fact, I walked off that... Do you remember, Pete, that pitch? Walking off that pitch at the Calderon. He stopped, didn't he, Pep, with a photographer he knew to pose with the cup about 12 feet from us as we literally walked across the cup final pitch and out down this sort of vehicle tunnel at the end. It's mental that you could do that. And I don't know what your memories of it, Pete, are, but just to be within 10 feet of that moment... They were radiating happiness and it felt great. Of course, Estiarte has said that on that pitch, before the final, after the final, it was a really bittersweet feeling because he and Pep felt betrayed. They both felt that people now in power at Camp Nou, since the elections, were trying to menospreciar, were trying to drag down the who'd achieved these things and to make it seem as if it's just the greatness of Barcelona had won all the things, and that Pep and his new ideas and disciplines weren't all that important. So, Ian, it was a bittersweet leave, and his relationships at Bayern Munich were, even though there were ex-players and one on the board who didn't believe in the passing to create space, passing to drag your opponents about. Everybody else who knows anything, Rummenigge particularly, senior footballers at that club, Lahm is devoted to him. They all knew that they'd never played anything like that, that Bayern Munich had never seen anything like that. And the only thing that was missing was the Champions League.
There was a sense also in 2011 that they'd reached perfection, I think, or he'd reached perfection. And we know that he's a perfectionist. And I think that was part of the reason why he thought this might be the time to go, even though he ended up staying for another year. Because the closest thing I've seen to football perfection is 2009, when they go to the Bernabeu and beat Real Madrid 6-2. And when it's Henri and Eto'o either side of Messi, and they've got Yaya Touré pounding his way through the middle of the pitch. But that's not Pep's version of perfection. Pep's version of perfection is with little Pedro and little Villa either side of Messi, and Busquets, Xavi and Iniesta in midfield. And I just think it was so good against United, and they were so invincible at that stage that he thought to himself, as a perfectionist, where do you go from here? This is as close to perfection as it's going to be. And then onto the backdrop of all the things that Graham's talked about, we can't forget the Mourinho effect as well, that had taken so much out of him. So exhaustion, and also the point of, you know, reaching the point where you think this is maybe not going to get any better. We're going to have to. It's like, you know, Che Guevara causing a revolution in one country and then thinking, well, I've done that and I need to go and cause a revolution in another country now, rather than staying to see it through until it almost loses its essence, as it were. So why not go and try and do what everyone said was impossible? You can do this at Barcelona, you can do this in Spain, you're not going to be able to do it in the Bundesliga, and you're definitely not going to be able to do it in England. And that's what he's ultimately proved people wrong on.
Viva la revolución! Viva la revolución! Let's draw the line, though, because Ian deserves the last part of the answer, which is that if you look at the late insecurity at Barcelona because of Rosset, and if you look at the lack of the Champions League at Bayern, which was a stone in his shoe, he treats the Champions League like it's an individual beast with a character of its own, irrespective of your rival, and talks at length about how hard it is to win. But at City, think about what he's got around him. The owner is devoted to him, has given him complete confidence, irrespective of whether they're at the highest or mid-ebb of what Guardiola was bought to City for. He's got Ferran Soriano, who was one of the main architects of creating the right environment at Camp Nou, and he's got Chicky Pickerstein, with whom he's been playing football since 1990, or working with. And therefore, if you take what he experienced at Foot Club Barcelona for good and bad in Munich, whereby it was close to nirvana because they gave him carte blanche, they wanted him to stay. And this time he went, no, I know when I'm going. I know when the end is. And although he wanted to be at Manchester United and expected Manchester United to sign him, this I know is a fact, what he's found at City is the hybrid of everything that he wanted. An extremely good squad, their willingness to rebuild it, total control over all the matters that are important to him. And above it, he doesn't have to manage up. He's got people above him who understand him, who trust him, and who allow him to do the best work. So in that instance, you know, I think Ian should look at the context of City through the sort of wing mirror of looking back at what type of Pep we've got now.
And just one more reason as to why he stayed for longer. I also think he wants to prove that, you know, he can bring players through. And he was criticised so often in the first couple of years of, you know, all well and good, you're bringing through the young Catalan lads in Barcelona. When are we going to have someone from the academy come through? And Brahim Diaz goes off and Sancho goes off. But now we've got Foden, and Foden is looking like he's going to be sensational. So that process takes time. And you, if you want to do that, you can't be in and out in 3 years. Because of the three that come through that everyone else thinks is a world beater, Pep only thinks one is, and he has to wait for that player to mature and develop. And even the first half of this season, he still wasn't in the team regularly, was he? But now he's, you know, he'll be a starter on tomorrow for sure.
On to the final. Well, let's take a quick break, and then our sponsors at Bet365 have asked us which members of this City team would get into the 2011 Barcelona lineup from Wembley. Quick break now, we'll be back with Pete and Graham's answers to that one very soon.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay, we're back. Six of the Barcelona team in 2011 were trained in the Cantera. We're going to imagine perfect assimilation. So when we consider these Manchester City players, we're going to imagine that they would all assimilate perfectly into the system, almost as if they had been trained at the Cantera. So much more Dani Alves and David Villa than Zlatan Ibrahimovic or Alexander Kleb or any of the other guys that didn't quite mesh as well. We know the team that started at Wembley. Victor Valdez, Dani Alves, Javi Mascherano, Gerard Piqué, Eric Abidal, Sergio Busquets, Xavi, Andres Iniesta, David Villa, Leo Messi and Pedro. When it comes to City, it's really hard, I think, to predict a starting 11. So I'm going to give you loads of choices and let's just see if any of them even come into contention to break into a team that many people think was the best they ever saw. Let's start with the goalkeeper. Graham Hunter, I know that you're a Victor Valdez fan. What do you think of Ederson in comparison?
Look, I'll start by saying that although it's an interesting exercise, I think everybody who's watched both teams is going to find it very hard to put a City player in that Barca 11. This is an interesting one, admittedly, because one of the key things that Victor Valdez had above and beyond the fact that he was a pretty good goalkeeper, and the other thing that stands out is that he's an extraordinary character. Not easy, but in terms of winner's mentality, competitive attitude, aggression, he's high up the list. But Edison shares with him this ability to play football and the ability to understand. People call it playing out from the back. I'm not certain that Pep uses that term much. What he wants is to have 11 footballers, and he wants, once City are trying to draw, and Barcelona were trying to draw their opponents into places that they shouldn't be and then beat that first line of pressure, he sees it as being a 5 or 6 man passing exercise. And one of the players isn't a goalkeeper. He's just a good receiver and passer of the ball who can help you break the first line of. So playing out from the back signifies the idea that instead of kicking long, you're going to pass it out and go directly up the pitch. And that's not what Guardiola is doing. And therefore, Ederson's place in this argument becomes quite significant, because he's much bigger, taller, more robust than Valdez. And in the modern game, although referees and the FIFA laws, the IFAB laws, give much more protection to goalkeepers, there's a degree of which, if you look back at the way in which John Terry and Carvalho blocked Valdez in the Chelsea game under Mourinho, when Barcelona under Rijkaard were knocked out, you know, blocking off of goalkeepers still happens. Barcelona lost a goal recently where Ter Stegen made out that he was being shoved around by, I think, Thierry Correa. That's off the top of my head, memory-wise. And you don't really do that very much to Ederson. So I think there's an argument here. There's a real argument, because you're talking about two footballers who share so many composite ideas that Pep has, that if Pep was in this discussion, maybe he'd pick Ederson. So, for the want of an argument, and for the want of... I'm really glad you let me go first, because, tough shit on Pete now trying to find the next City player who's going to get into that starting 11. But I'm going to cheat and say that, even though in sentiment terms, I would always pick Victor Valdez. And happily, I know him better than poor old Ederson. But maybe, sort of, kind of, Ederson.
Pete, I'm going to give you the entire back four to see if you can find a way in here. So we have Kyle Walker playing off against Dani Alves, Mascherano and Pique against any two from Stones, Diaz and Laporte, and then Eric Abidal versus Oleksandr Zinchenko. I don't know if you can find any cracks in the 2011 defence.
Well, the obvious one, but you're not allowing us to do it, is to put Ruben Diaz in alongside Pique.
Yes, you can. You don't have to slot. It's not 4-4-4. Any one of those that you like, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, Ruben Diaz has had a brilliant season. First season at City. And sometimes to judge how well a player's done, the best thing to do is to look at the player next to him. And you look at John Stones and how John Stones has improved this season with Ruben Diaz alongside him. And Mascherano was always... it was always a make-do. It was a brilliant make-do. And it made do for at least three seasons. But Ruben Diaz is a defender through and through. And, I mean, if you're gonna force us to pick somebody, then I think... I don't completely disagree with Graham, actually, because I think with Valdez, it always felt like it was hard for him to do what he ended up doing. And there's that brilliant moment in the book and the film that Graham's behind, of Valdez being sat down by Pep and being told, you know, this is how we're going to play. That, you know, Pique and Puyol are going to be on the basically on the touchline. You're going to pass them. And Valdez said that again.
He said, I'd forgot that. He says it sounded Chinese to me.
Exactly, yeah. You know, I mean, although he came through La Masia and he would have been capable with his feet, I still think he found it hard to play the extreme sport that Pep wanted them to play. And who knows? Yeah, maybe Graham's right in terms of who Pep would pick as his goalkeeper, sentiment aside. But I think Ruben Diaz would be my choice of the City defenders to get into that Barca defence. Wouldn't go with anyone other than Abidal. Alves is the best right back I've ever seen, and you're not going to take Pique out, but we'll slip Diaz in there.
City team are doing better than I thought already. Okay, I want you both to contribute to the midfield, because you both saw so much of them, and they're such a legendary sort of trio at this point. So Busquets, Xavi, and Iniesta almost roll off the tongue as if they were one entity. Pep has accumulated 1,000 midfielders at City, and you know they're pretty much all remarkable. So you guys can take anybody from Fernandinho, Rodri, Gundogan, Foden, De Bruyne, Bernardo Silva. Do any of them do any better than first replacement for those three?
Allow me to retort. Our man in from Inglewood says, look, just let's cut to the chase. No. Not only for that match, but Busquets, Iniesta and Xavi aren't, you know, as you joke, they aren't that far from a single thinking, breathing, reacting, planning unit. And my contention, although I've never asked them, you and I sat in, when we did the Ilkay Gundogan interview recently, Gundogan's eyes lit up. He was still reverential about the Barcelona midfield that he saw. And his one dream at you know, at Bochum and subsequently at Dortmund was to try and play for Pep in that Barcelona team. I think if you sat Gundogan down and said, would you, you know, be a natural swap for prime Busquets, Iniesta and Xavi in that 2011 team? I think he would say no. And I'm going to argue now to cut to the chase. From my perspective, there might come a time when Foden is a yes, but now it's too soon. Rodri has I don't enjoy watching Rodri for Spain. I think he's become a little slower, a little bit more cumbersome. I think he's, you know, he's 2-3 kilos not lithe enough, and he doesn't see your pass like Busquets. He's impressive. He's a guy who can make a difference tomorrow, but does he unseat prime Busquets? No, that idea is nonsensical. And you can keep going through Bernardo Silva if you want. It doesn't really matter until the three of us come to De Bruyne. And you, Bicho Raro, is he a midfielder? Is he an attacker? Is he a 10? Can he play wide? So that's where I think the next part of this chat is going. Because I'm gonna just take my life in my hands and say that Messi stays in this hybrid team. There you go.
It's a big call, but...
Well, listen, I've got the cojones for it. So there we are, Peter. We're left with two players. Produce pet perfection.
The possible solution is that me and you have both, Graham, seen Andres Iniesta play in the front three and brilliantly, and do it brilliantly many, many times. And, you know, I would make the argument that you put De Bruyne in there, and you can put De Bruyne behind Iniesta, or you can put Iniesta behind De Bruyne. But you somehow get De Bruyne into that team because, you know, I said it was perfection earlier, and Pep would certainly call it perfection. But if there's one way you could improve on it, will be putting De Bruyne in there. So what we're saying, De Bruyne in for Iniesta, and Iniesta ends up in the front three. Where they end up at any given moment in the game is another story.
Which leaves us with 12 players at the moment, Rafa Benitez style. You are aware that we've currently got 12 players, yeah? Pete correctly talked about Pedro and Villa being part of Pep perfection either side of Messi. Both of them score.
Villa goes to me. Pedro is one of the most underrated footballers that's ever been born. And there's a great show on Spanish. In fact, it's an internet thing in Spanish sports journalism that basically rips the piss out of the markers and the asses and that and the Chiringuito shows and that, and they basically soundbite various things through the season that they hear, and one of them that they hear is someone on Chiringuito, I think, saying and Pedro's better than Neymar, and they all laugh about it. But actually, you know what? I wouldn't mind. I'd go with Pedro ahead of Neymar in my team, especially for a final. He's going to score. He's going to get two chances. He's going to put one of them away. So you're not. I'm not taking Pedro out of the team. So David Villa is the player that has to go for me. So you end up with Busquets, Xavi, De Bruyne, Iniesta, Pedro, Messi.
Yeah, listen. I don't think you can win this argument. It's left me. I mean, I'm not just participating in this. I'm genuinely bereft, and I, you know, you doubt yourself when you. I suppose it's one of the ways we can feel linked to managers who tell us, not every manager, but elite managers who say, I remember Ferguson talking about having to leave Park out of one of these games, and Park's parents had come over from Korea, and he had to say to them, listen, your boy's not playing. And he talked about how, you know, one of the toughest guys that's ever kicked a ball or managed, mentioning that it really stung him, that really hurt him. And they, you know, Zidane makes a big fuss about that, about hating leaving players out, and I'm beginning to feel the same way, because I feel a really strong affection to these people because they changed our life. But you, me and Pete, not one of us is a Barcelona supporter, but they changed our lives, they changed our careers, they changed our articulacy, they gave us completely new horizons, they've ensured for Pete and I that, you know, life in Spain was viable. More viable than it had previously been, and the enjoyment for the three of us and everybody who's listening in terms of the quality of football they played. So, and now we're going to drop one of them. Bet365, you know, for shame. That's all I'm saying. And I know you're not supposed to say that to sponsors, but for shame, leave them alone. Hands off. There you go, and I've dodged saying who I think gets dropped.
Only the highest goal scorer in Spanish football history.
Not a bad first sub. Apologies to Raheem Sterling and Riyad Mahrez, who didn't even get a look in either side of the one banker pick up front. But I think the point has been made. That was really, really good fun. Thank you, both of you, for your contribution there.
I'm down in the dumps. You might have enjoyed it, but I didn't.
Oh, I had a great
I'm down
time.
In the dumps.
That was a lot of fun. To round things off, we had three socios who wanted to talk about broadly connected themes. Here's Tom Lee first.
Hi, Graham and Pete. Socio Tom Lee here with one with regards to this year's Champions League final. What I'd like to know is, in your opinion, if not tarnished or devalued, is there at least a question mark over this year's game contested between Manchester City and Chelsea, given that the aforementioned side, backed by a sovereign wealth fund with a questionable human rights record, up against a team who are backed by a Russian oligarch, no less. So it's not exactly the magic and the romance of the cup. I'm not saying other teams haven't spent big to get to the top table on the biggest stage, but this really is the most overt example, I would suggest, of teams who, well, these two in particular, if you think back into the not too distant past, both of them could have gone to the wall had things gone differently. Here they are at the top table. Question mark, yes or no?
Stephen O'Reilly and Jake Garlick, also connected to Tom's point. Stephen was asking for your view on what he sees as a rather soulless end to a soulless season. No fans for the majority of it, and now two super rich clubs with kind of second tier supporter bases being the last ones standing in this sort of war of attrition. And then Jake Garlick wonders whether Spain's top teams are now a level behind the super rich Premier League teams, and I guess PSG as well, when it comes to competing for available superstars in each window, and whether or not those Spanish teams are now handicapped somewhat in this competition as a result.
Stephen's touched on something that is an antidote to how morose I was feeling after that hybrid 11. I understand the argument, but I don't feel the same. For example, and I could pick on other matches, but the first leg of Bayern Paris Saint-Germain, not soulless. I thought that game was utterly extraordinary. I mean, it ranks in the top 10 of games I've seen over the last 10 years. It was unusual. It was a slugfest. It was Jake LaMotta football. It wasn't controlled. It was totally open. It was punch and counter punch. It really did look as if Bayern might win 7-4. But in the end, I mean, again, Stephen, from memory, they lost 2-3 at home. And I would say that the first leg of City Paris Saint-Germain, again, I thought it was immense. And the way in which Paris Saint-Germain initially looked as if they were going to, if not pummel City, but they had their mark, that they were still carrying verve and certainty into the game from the quarterfinal. And to watch the way that City sucked them into a game that Paris Saint-Germain didn't want to play. And then, okay, in the interview I did, Pep talked about like the minute details about where the wall breaks, how the ball from Mahrez goes through them, the fact that it should have hit the wall, it shouldn't have been a good free kick, but it is because of just the tiniest rotation of one of the bodies in the wall. These things, I absolutely love them. And I don't think it'll be a soulless end, and I don't. The lack of fans affects all of us, but the fact we've had football during this latter year or 10 months of a world pandemic, I think it's an unappreciated miracle. I can understand that a lot of people in positions of governance in society probably didn't want football to restart. And the fact that we haven't had mass numbers of fans conglomerating outside stadiums, the fact that the players and the physios and the wives and the kids and the managers have all been willing to take massive risks with COVID. COVID kills. You know, footballers have... I want to relate soulless to Simeone, to me, I've been arguing, had a par season because they should have won the league. But he raised it, to my taste, Stephen, to four under par with his discourse after winning the final game and lifting the league. And he talked about, this is different, this is special because we've lost people. This is for the fans who've died. This is for the people that we at this club know personally who haven't made it through. That's right. And there will be some people across the world and in the communities that we share who take succour from having had football these last 10 months. And I think it's been amazing, genuinely amazing. I'll never forget these months. And it's not the same without fans. And it hurts to see empty stadiums. And I think we've taken our footballers and just about everybody involved them and wrung them dry. And I think somebody's got, like Inigo Martinez pulling out of the Spain squad the other day, saying, "I'm neither physically nor, you know, emotionally correct to go and play a tournament." Well done. Now watch others come out and say that, because we're squeezing the last drops out of our footballers. But I just view it, Stephen, with total respect for what you said, I just view it completely differently. And that's from the heart. I can't believe what football's achieved since, certainly in Spain, since June last year when it restarted. I find it an unregistered, unpraised sporting miracle and social miracle, I think.
Pete, I'll ask you about the Spanish angle in a minute, but Graham, just to come back to the other side of Stephen's point, which was, I guess, the difference and on a sort of long-term post-COVID view, the difference between a final like the one that we mentioned between legacy superpowers, Barcelona and Manchester United, compared to Manchester City and Chelsea, who for a shorthand, you know, the nouveau riche with less sort of history in the competition. Does it matter to you?
No, listen, I think there needs to be culpability and accountability in football. Barcelona have made a fucking pig's breakfast of what they've been doing in recent seasons, and it's come home to roost. The socios, the members, need to take responsibility because they voted for Bartomeu and Rosé over the last decade, and this is what's happened. And it's a desperate situation, and Barcelona will be different for a short period, and they will be financially strapped for a longer period. I don't believe that Madrid are in the same position. They patently lost, you know, hundreds of millions because of the circumstances. However, they've made fewer misspends. They had a couple of summers where the actual outlay wasn't gigantic. The stadium is costing them a lot, but it's going to become, when times are normal and it's completed, a massive, massive revenue generator. And I think that Madrid's ability to cope is going to become more robust than Barcelona's. And the other clubs in Spain weren't mentioned by Tom or Jake or Stephen. But I think a lot of them have had governance which and have had outlays whereby the losses are going to be slightly easier to sustain. Not to be able to compete with Paris Saint-Germain or Manchester City or Chelsea. Clearly not, no. But when you see Inter winning the title for the first time in I don't know how many years since, 11 years since 2010, I think, and immediately telling Conte there's going to have to be wage cuts and we're going to have to sell players, that group of clubs that the lads mentioned is becoming an increasingly small group. And it might be that Barcelona and Real Madrid's plight is exacerbated further if UEFA, who have opened disciplinary proceedings against them, eliminate them from the Champions League for a year or two as a punishment for the European Halfwit League, which, frankly, is what should happen. So there's going to be differences. And I think that the Phoenix element at Barcelona has to be for good because they've lost their core values and they've lost their Cruyff Bible. And that has to be restored because that's now part of the identity of the club. Like it or not, for time immemorial, in my opinion. So, you know, to some extent, in Barcelona's case, tough shit. And for Real Madrid, I think that no matter how loudly they complain about not being able to buy Haaland this year, and Florentino rushing into the Super League because he thought he could get the, you know, the investment money, venture capitalist money quickly and buy Haaland and Mbappe. You know, okay, you grab at what you can if you're in an all stakes poker game. You grab the cards you think are yours. But I think their recuperation will be much, much quicker. And there will be a time simply when the state funded clubs are going to have to will be able to outbuy, but will they be able to outtrain, outplay, outplan? That's a different question.
Yeah, in terms of what Graham was saying about the social and the sporting achievement of getting football back on, I don't think it can be estimated how important the players have been in this and how difficult it's been with them to play without supporters, without an audience. But I spoke to Alberto Moreno before the Europa League final, and he said that when he ran out against Sevilla, the first game with fans back for Villarreal, there weren't many there, but he said the hairs on the back of his neck stood up. You know, it was a shock as well, having been without them for so long. But, you know, it's like going into the gym and there's no one there. And you think, oh, shit, I've got to motivate myself for this one. We can't underestimate how... And some matches have been played as if there were 100,000 people shouting at the top of their voices. And that's a huge, huge credit to the players. It really is. Because it doesn't matter how much you get paid. It doesn't change the fact that you're motivating yourself in this sort of situation. And the other thing about it being soulless, because I think part of the point of the question was, these super rich clubs reaching the final. I don't think they're all the same. I don't think you can put, for example, the last four teams in the Champions League, Real Madrid, PSG, Chelsea and Man City. Yeah, they've all got an endless supply of money. But they haven't all used it the same way. You know, I mean, PSG are a club that... weren't patient with Emery, then they weren't patient with Tuchel, now they've ended up with a manager who can't even win the French League. Last season they were beaten in the Champions League final by one of their former youth players who they didn't manage to keep hold of. Yeah, they spent lots of money, but on obvious players. They go out and they get the biggest player of their neighbours, Monaco. They go out and get Mbappe, then they go and spend 222 million euros on Neymar just because they can, and actually that hasn't brought them the thing that they really want. Whereas clubs where a little bit more thought's gone into it, because Manchester City spend a lot of money, but Pep Guardiola goes out and buys four fullbacks. He doesn't just go out and buy the player that everyone's talking about, the player that's got 40 goals and has won the Ballon d'Or. And Chelsea in a similar vein, and Chelsea will have Mason Mount on the pitch in the final, and Foden will be there for City. So, you know, just having money is not enough. And we have to give City and Chelsea some credit for what they've done with that money, who they've put in charge of making the decisions. At Real Madrid, no one's in charge of making the decisions as far as signings are concerned. It's a mishmash of the president and who he decides to pick the phone up and speak to on any given day. So City and Chelsea, soulless, well... there are degrees in everything. They've got an awful lot of money, but they use it well. And I think, like Graham, it'll be a great final, despite the fact that we'd all rather it played in a full stadium.
Thank you, gentlemen. That is all, not just for this episode of The Big Interview, but for this season of The Big Interview. Thank you so much for listening, and especially to the socios, our members at patreon.com/GrahamHunter, who support us and provide the questions for these Q&A shows. But we will be back very, very, very soon. Graham, would you like to tell the nice people what's coming this summer?
I'll have a little stab at it. I'm going to play lots of golf.
It's not really what I had in mind.
Look, we're fortunate in that our sponsors, Bet365, have supported the idea of us bringing daily content from the European Championships to you. And it will be in a version of what we tried from the Russian World Cup, where I flew with the squad around that part of the continent and got to see training and so on and so forth. I'm hoping and anticipating that there'll be some similarities this summer where training will be open, there'll be interviews with players, and as we stand, I'm at the matches too. So between the lot of us, we'll be bringing you content that tries to tell you about the characters, the strategy, the crisis management that goes on up close during a European Championship, and looking at other games across the tournament where either by fluke I've had the chance to speak to somebody, or when it's one of the big games of this summer coming up, notably how it is that Scotland beat England at Wembley. I think I've used the right tense there.
Perfect. We look forward to that episode in particular. So, we'll see you guys at the Euros. For now, from Graham, from Pete, from Martin and I at Backpage, thank you for listening this season. Have a lovely day and be careful out there.